This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. John L. Hancox may be the most influential Arkansas musician most people have never heard of, or even heard. He was born in Brinkley in 1904 and was an influential force behind the formation of the Southern Tenants Farm Union. He also, in his 30s, began writing poems and songs to support the labor movement. He left Arkansas in the 1930s and was not heard from for most of the next 50 years. Michael K. Honey, a professor of humanities at the University of Washington in Tacoma, has written a book about the life of John L. Hancox called Sharecropper's Troubadour. Earlier this month, Michael K. Honey visited the University of Arkansas, and during his visit, he told Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums that he wrote the book, in part, to bring the story of John L. Hancox to a wider audience.
He disappeared in 1937-38. A lynch mob ran him out of eastern Arkansas. And the only reason we know about him at all is that after he left Arkansas, he did a series of recordings with Pete Seeger's father, Charles Seeger, at the Library of Congress. And so those are still there, and there's a CD of those songs now from the University of West Virginia Press. But then he left the South altogether and went to San Diego. And Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, and other people put together a book. Alan Lomax put together a book of songs called Hard-Hitting Songs for Hard-Hit People about the Great Depression. John's got some great material in there, and they tried to find him in 1967 when that book came out, and they couldn't find any trace of him. They thought he was dead. And in 1985, I was a graduate student, and I was living in Washington, D.C., and we had these things called the Great Labor Arts Exchange, where we'd bring in musicians, and I organized a panel on labor and civil rights and songs of the South, and Pete Seeger was one of the panelists, and just right around that same time, he discovered John Hancox was still alive, and so we brought him to the conference, and he was a tremendous hit.
He would have been early 80s at this point,
he would have
right?
been, I think, about 84 okay. or something like that. And he was very stately and a little bit frail, but still pretty robust. And as soon as he walked in the room and started singing Roll the Union On, everybody burst into song because everybody knew that song. And he became a huge hit on sort of the labor folk scene. And he started traveling with Pete Seeger. He was at the Vancouver Folk Festival, which is a huge event in Canada, and various labor kind of oriented events for the next 7 years, and then he died. So he had like a second life. I call him, his first poems that he wrote were published in the Southern Tenant Farmers Union newspaper, The Sharecropper's Voice, and he used the pen name John Henry because he didn't want the planters to know his real name. John Henry being the famous steel-driving man of the great folk song. So in 1985, I called it the Second Coming of John Henry because he was that same kind of historical,
right.
mythological sort of figure.
Larger than life.
Larger
sort of.
Than life. So he came back, you know, but he could just as easily have languished in total obscurity. And then when I was there at this event, Ralph Rinsler, who ran the Smithsonian Folklife Program, said, well, you can't just bring this person here. Somebody's got to interview him. So he paid me $100, and I went and interviewed him for a couple of days. And that got this project started, but it took me all these years later to come back to it and turn it into a book.
You mentioned that he left eastern Arkansas in 1937.
Mm-hmm.
A lynch mob coming for him because of his activities trying to organize?
Yes. The Southern Tenant Farmers Union was a really incredible occurrence. John grew up in Brinkley, Arkansas in 1904. He was born there, as you mentioned, sort of a contemporary of Rosetta Tharpe and Louis Jordan and also a guy named Big Bill Brunzi. They all came from that area. Well, all of those musicians left except John, and he was really not a musician. He was in a large family, 11 brothers and sisters, working on rented and purchased land, and they were actually in pretty good shape until the 1920s, and then everything went bad in cotton country. The prices of cotton dropped after World War One, and then his father got killed by a team of runaway mules that threw him out of the wagon. He hit his head against a tree and broke his neck, and John sat there and watched him die. And so then John took over the family with these 11 or 10 siblings. And by the 1930s, he had become a sharecropper. They said that, you know, you had an agricultural ladder and each step would take you up, but instead each step took him down. So he went from being sort of self-sufficient to being a sharecropper, which is totally not self-sufficient. And finally, in 1935, a group of people in Tyranza, Arkansas, organized the Southern Tenant Farmers Union, and that's where the story kind of starts. And that union was amazing because the last time anybody tried to organize sharecroppers in Arkansas was 1919 in Lane, Arkansas.
And we know what happened
there.
It
had a huge race riot. Hundreds of people were killed, lynchings and everything else. And, of course, the trick there was they turned the whites against the blacks. And so when they organized in 1934, they had only seven people to start it. They said, well, should we have separate unions because blacks and whites are not supposed to be, you know, together in according to the segregation laws. And they said one of the survivors of the Elaine massacre, African-American, said, no, you know, that's how they killed us last time. We can't do that. So it wasn't, they weren't seeking integration. They didn't talk about it that way. They just talked about it. We're all in this together. And they did some really significant things. They used Mr. and Mrs. titles for everybody, So that meant whites were calling blacks Mr. or Mrs. Instead of auntie and uncle and all the demeaning ways people would talk. That was just a rule. And also they held interracial meetings. And so John's role, eventually, they had a big strike in 1935 during the harvest season that was successful and raised their incomes by 50%. So suddenly they had 30,000 members all over Arkansas, southeast Missouri, parts of Oklahoma. And John wasn't in the union at that point, but he started, he was going door to door selling fish. He quit sharecropping, and he started fishing out of the river and taking the fish in buckets and going door to door. He was pretty entrepreneurial, and he also made pop and moonshine and popcorn, and he sold that from a mule, you know, walking around or going around with a mule. And so while he was going door to door, he started collecting union memberships. And on these plantations, these were like police states where you were totally controlled by the landlord, but he would just come to the door and sell you something. And meanwhile, wouldn't you like to join this union?
I'm curious, do we know, was he writing, and maybe you asked him about this when you interviewed him in the 80s, did he write for himself or did he consciously write songs that he knew would have a good chance of bringing people together, that would rally people together?
He was writing for the union. He wasn't writing for himself. Let me his first poem. Was called The Planter and the Sharecropper, and it was published under the name of John Henry and appeared in the Sharecropper's Voice. And it's a very long poem, and I don't think anybody who had not lived that life would be able to describe things the way he does. I won't play the whole thing because it's too long, but so I put a little tune to it. The planter lives off the sweat of the sharecropper's brow. How the sharecropper lives, the planter cares not how. The planter has good and wholesome food to eat. Sharecropper gets cornbread and fat bag meat. Sharecropper's wife goes to the kitchen, wash tub and field. Planter's wife enjoys a fancy automobile. Planter's children dresses fine and goes to school. Sharecroppers puts on rags and follows the mule.
When his sharecropper dies, he's buried in a box without any necktie, without any socks. And if anybody doubts this ain't the truth, you can go down south and you can see the proof. Well, planner, what the heaven is the matter with you? What has your labor ever done to you? Upon his back, you just to sit and ride. Don't you think your labor gonna ever get tired?
We mentioned that there were the recordings at the Library of Congress, but he also kind of went out of the public eye. Did he keep writing during that time?
You know, I'm not sure. He you know, to make a living, he became very entrepreneurial once again. He built houses, had people who were migrants from the South rent. So it's just like most immigrants, you know, there'd be 10, 15 people sleeping in a house. And then he raised vegetables and sold them off the back of a truck, went fishing, sold the fish, became a carpenter for a while, but discovered there was a lot of racism in the union, so that was an issue for him too. So most of the time he was just trying to make a living and taking care of grandchildren and stuff like that. And he had three marriages, so he was busy that way too. I think the music sort of kind of came back to him in the 80s. By the time I met him in 85, he had actually started writing again and had gotten some attention in San Diego in the newspapers. And then he really wrote a lot of things from then on in. He wrote a lot of poems about growing old, hospitalization, what that was like, love poems. And then he wrote these political ones. Let me do just one quick thing. This was something he sent me the words to, and then we worked on it together and presented it at the Labor Heritage Foundation. So this is 1986, during the reign of Ronald Reagan. Jobless, jobless in the USA. People are looking for work every day. Someone has taken their jobs away. Jobless in the USA. Hunger, hunger in the USA. People are going into garbage cans. Someone's taking their jobs away. Hunger in the USA. Homeless, homeless in the USA. People are living in cars every day. People without a place to stay. The banks have taken their homes away. Homeless in the USA. Working, working in the USA. Working for a better day. Working till we have some say. We're gonna make some changes in the USA. We gotta make some changes in the USA. So he was still thinking very politically, and in my interviews with him, he talked a lot about his fear that mechanization was throwing all these people out of work. It happened where he was originally with cotton production, mm-hmm. but it was happening with everything else. And he told me, he said, a lot of times I wake up at night sort of sweating and thinking, what's going to happen to all these people when they don't have jobs anymore?
Well, that's interesting. I was going to ask if you got a sense, here he was in his 80s, everything he had been through, had seen. Did you get a sense whether he had any optimism for the future? Did you talk to him about
that? He was very optimistic. That was an interesting thing about him. Someone growing up in his circumstances, this surprised me, actually, when I put the book together. The book was a lot of research on my part because I had the interviews with him, but I didn't have the context. And he told me his personal story, but I needed to understand what was going on around that story. So it took me a long time, actually, to piece it all together. And under the circumstances, I was really surprised at how optimistic he was. So his ninth grade, what he called his graduation speech, he talked about scaling the heights of glory, and the principal asked him what did he want to be when he grew up, and he said, I want to be like George Washington. He said, oh, you mean George Washington Carver. He said, no, I mean I want to be the president. And that never left him, you know, despite all the things that happened to him, you know, the privations and the almost starvation and the lynch mob, and he always was can-do. And I think it came out of his family being a little bit better off in the sense that they owned some land at the beginning and that they had their own chickens and cows and were self-sufficient and didn't go into debt until the 20s. And so he always knew that it was possible to live a decent life. And he just kept fighting for that. And he said at the end, I'm going to live till I die anyway, so I'm going to make the best out of whatever I have. And he just was like that. He was an inspiring character.
Michael K. Henney is a professor of humanities at the University of Washington and the author of the book Sharecropper's Troubadour about Arkansas-born John L. Hancock's. You can learn more about the author, the book, and the subject at michaelhenney.com. He was on the University of Arkansas campus earlier this month, and during his visit, he talked with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums.